Any of my staff on the immigration situation? Today, our presenter is Lisa Madison. She's coming, well, she's a labor sociologist, and she's coming from the Tilburg Law School in University in the Netherlands. She's working there as a postdoc, and her institution is called Intermix. Mm-hmm. She's currently working on undocumented labor migrants in the Netherlands, but today Lisa is going to talk about a previous project where she worked on for her PhD. And the topic is on hypermobile migrants and their lack of social protection within the EU. So you have 30 minutes,
Yeah. You
have sandwiches there, and then we will leave on the table.
Yeah. Perfect. Thank you so much, Dominique. Thanks for the introduction. That was also how I would introduce myself, so I can skip that already. So that's nice. So I'm currently a postdoc and working on irregular labor migration within a project called Protection of Labor Migrants in the Netherlands. So it's all my research has been based in the Netherlands, very receiving country point of view. Today I'm going to talk to you about my previous project, which was my PhD project. I finished that last year, defended early this year, and that was based on qualitative empirical fieldwork in the Netherlands as well, but with EU labor migrants. And these migrants were very mobile across EU borders. So I did, in total, the qualitative basis of my research was around 70 interviews with 100 migrants. There are a bit more migrants I interviewed than actual interviews that I did, because I sometimes interviewed them with two of them at the same time, or three migrants at the same time, basically because that's how I encountered them, or if they prefer to be interviewed together, then we did it like that. But I think around 50 migrants were interviewed individually, so those interviews were a bit more in-depth than the ones I did with multiple migrants at the same time. This was complemented with expert interviews with trade union officials, employers, associations, labor enforcement agents, to get a more complete picture of what was going on in terms of rights of these workers. And I also did, most of the expert interviews were with trade union officials, because I also did participant observation of trade union tactics to organize these migrants, or at least to try to change the conditions of these migrants, so to protect them from substandard employment conditions. So what I'm going to talk to you about today is the basic finding amongst these migrants that they often work under substandard working conditions, but that you see, even though in theory and in law they have certain rights ascribed to them, is very difficult in practice to really enforce those rights or claim those rights for these migrants. So you see that they're basically in a situation where de facto they are quite excluded from their labor rights when they work abroad. So given that, what can trade unions do to protect their position in the Netherlands? But also how do workers themselves act under these constraints of the European labor market? Because it's basically very important to also consider how the labor market in Europe is constructed if we talk about the employment conditions of these workers. So my background is the PhD research was basically more in industrial relations, sociology of work. So that's why I'm just telling you that, because then you know that I'm coming from more of an employment perspective when I look at these matters. So first of all, what are we talking about in terms of working conditions of EU mobile workers in the Netherlands? Well, in the Netherlands, I've basically summed up here some numbers and compared the Netherlands with its neighboring countries, so the UK, Germany, and Belgium. In the Netherlands, labor migration has increased, especially since the EU enlargement, so 2004, 2007. We had transitional measures in place till 2007 for the first round of accession countries, which was, amongst others, Poland, for example. And then you see when these were lifted in 2007 that migration from Eastern Europe and especially from Poland increased a lot in the Netherlands. This is data from Eurostat, so that means that these are registered nationals, so people that have registered with the city councils, for example. So the data is not ideal because a lot of EU migrants are very mobile, so they only work for short periods in another country. So if in the Netherlands you work for less than 4 months, you usually don't register with the cities, so you don't show up in these data. But just to give you a certain a comparison with what is going on in terms of labor flows in the other countries. So we compare to the Netherlands to the UK, you see that also the UK has seen an enormous increase in terms of labor migrants over these years, so 2004 till 2013. But even though the absolute number is smaller, of course, in the Netherlands, still the relative increase is quite similar to the increase in the UK. But if we compare to Germany, for example, you see that Germany already had a large inflow of foreign EU workers. So I put there EU 8 citizens, which means citizens from the accession countries in 2002 and 2004. So if you compare with Germany, you see that actually there the number only doubled. And I'm saying only, but in absolute terms, they had a lot of EU migrants there living there already. So just to get an idea of how big the phenomenon is in the Netherlands, but also compared to its neighboring countries. But if we zoom in to the Netherlands a bit more, this is different data from the Dutch statistics, which also includes data from tax authorities. So this means that also migrants that don't register in the Netherlands, in just the population registries, show up in this data. So you can also see that the numbers are much higher than the numbers I presented in the previous slide, because these are more accurate, but more difficult to compare across countries. And here you see that the number of EU migrants increased indeed since 2007, but not as enormously as the previous slides showed. And we see that Poland is the main country of origin for labor migrants in the Netherlands. So these are also only EU 8 nationals from the 2004 accession countries and from the 2007 countries, Bulgaria and Romania, that have a job in the Netherlands. So it's not considering unemployed EU migrants at this moment. I think that's the main point to take from this graph or table. Yeah, so if we look at migrant employment, I think quite similar to the UK, the Netherlands has a very flexible labor market, and agency work is one of the main jobs in which these migrants find employment. But also if you look at other sectors, I did interviews in construction, with construction workers, with workers in supermarket distribution sectors and in meat factories. Many of them work under agency contracts, but in construction you also see that they work for subcontracting firms, for example. And you see lots of outsourcing and subcontracting processes, which makes the employment relation quite complicated for these workers. And the conditions under which they work are quite precarious. Oftentimes, you see very short contracts with limited security. They can basically be fired anytime when the employer decides to do so. They face very limited protection. You see that they often work in the labor-intensive jobs. Many sectors, the low-skilled jobs, but I looked at construction, and in construction, these are usually skilled workers as well. So we have to make a differentiation there as well. And one thing you really see with that's very important with these types of labor flows within Europe is this employer-arranged migration context. Employers really are very important in arranging the whole migration process. So oftentimes workers get recruited in their country of origin. So I'll basically take Poland as an example because many of my informants were from Poland. So they get recruited by a Polish agency. That agency arranges the whole migration process to the Netherlands. So they arrange a van, transport the workers to the work site, arrange accommodation in the Netherlands. The agency firm usually also has a Polish coordinator working for them, so they don't even have to talk Dutch or English, and it's completely arranged by the employer, which creates certain dependencies as well amongst the workers, which puts them in more vulnerable positions as well. So for today, I'll zoom into the Dutch construction sector because those are the most mobile migrants. Also in the other sectors that are mobile, but not as cross-border mobile as the construction workers. The workers I interviewed often work for very short periods of time in different countries. So they would have a contract in the Netherlands for a couple of weeks, months, maybe a year, but not much longer than that. And then they move on to another construction site in Europe, but maybe as well beyond Europe. So they're very hypermobile, as I called them in one of the articles. In Dutch construction, you see that the majority of the work is on larger scale construction sites. So in construction, you have these big construction sites. I looked at energy plants that were built, and basically around thousands of workers are needed to really construct these energy plants. So these will be large scale construction. You have to really differentiate that from smaller scale construction, so just home renovations, for example. I didn't look at that, but basically only at these large construction sites where you see a lot of variety in terms of nationalities employed there. And on these large construction sites, you see that it's basically a lot of foreign workers that are working there. So the ones I looked into, mainly the majority of the workers came from abroad, except for higher up level management. That might have been Dutch, but sometimes was also foreign, for example. One of the main contractors at one of the sites was from Japan, Mitsubishi, so really very international workplaces. I followed the trade union in their approach to organize these workers on these construction sites, or at least to try to find out about the employment conditions of these workers on the construction sites. So I talked a lot with them. I joined them on visits to the sites, to the work or the houses of these, or the places where they were housed, and saw how they talked with workers to gain an understanding of the employment conditions of this group of workers. While they estimated that around 75% of the people they talked to were in fact not paid in accordance with the Dutch collective agreement wages. In the Netherlands, we do have a statutory minimum wage, but the wage in the construction sector is regulated via collective agreements, and that means a much higher wage than the statutory minimum wage. And one of the things that they saw is regular violations of working periods, minimum rest periods, and circumvention of social security payments. So not only were they oftentimes not paid in accordance with the collective agreements, they also had to work much more hours than they were allowed to had very limited rest periods, and the social security payments were oftentimes not made correctly. Most of the workers I interviewed were either working on an agency contract, so employed by a temporary work agency, or employed via a posted employer. So that would be a subcontractor from a different country. Another phenomenon that you see oftentimes with these EU workers is self-employed workers. I didn't encounter them in my research, but there's a lot of problems with self-employed workers as well. So I just want to mention that. Well, if we look more into the working conditions of these workers, more in general, also within Europe, we see that they often are accommodated in more in the dirty, dangerous, and degrading types of jobs. Also, you see that there is a certain hierarchy within the migrant labor force if we talk about these kind of jobs. So the EU mobile workers were the most recent ones to come in, and you see that they oftentimes switch between jobs more often than more established migrant groups. The problem with the working conditions of these mobile workers, there are some surveys around in different countries, but we don't have much country comparative data, and oftentimes we only have research based on interviews or small survey samples to really show what kind of conditions these workers are employed under. My research was also qualitative, so I can't really say, okay, these are in general the conditions that they under which they are employed in the Netherlands, but there are many studies out there and there are many indications that there are often violations of their labor rights. So low wages, long working hours, very short contracts, very insecure labor status in the countries where they work. Oftentimes they face discrimination, intimidation of their employers, very limited or no holidays, and sometimes even unsafe working conditions. If we look at the reasons why these workers are more prone to end up in these types of employment, well, first of all, the language barrier. As I said, they come in via this very employer-arranged process, so there is no need oftentimes to learn the language. Of course, the Netherlands is quite different from the UK, where sometimes the appeal for these migrants to move to the UK is basically to learn the English language as well. But in the Netherlands, there is, of course, no incentive to start learning Dutch. I mean, they might even move to the Netherlands to try to improve their English. But Dutch is not something that these migrants speak. And also English is often very poorly. I interviewed all my migrants using interpreters, translators, simply because the level of English or German or Dutch was not enough to do a proper interview with them. Another one is that they compare job conditions abroad with job conditions at home. If the wage differences between Europe are quite profound still, a Polish worker can sometimes earn up to four times as much in the Netherlands or any other Western country than at home. So this is really something to keep in mind as well. Moreover, sometimes job opportunities are very poorly in the regions where they come from. So these are really the standards to which they compare a job abroad. The employer dependency, as I mentioned, but also the lack of knowledge about labor rights in the country where they work, and also about how to claim them. You can imagine if you are a construction worker and you just move to the Netherlands to finish a job or do a job for a couple of weeks or a couple of months, that you're not at all familiar with how the system works in the Netherlands with collective agreement wages, for example, or with who is the enforcement authority where you could go to claim your rights, for example. So this is really a lack of knowledge amongst these workers. And another reason why their labor rights are often violated is because of the different regulatory channels that are present within Europe to arrange intra-EU mobility, which creates a very complicated and complex array of employment arrangements within Europe. So I think we're all quite familiar with the four freedoms of the EU: freedom of movement for goods, capital, services and people. But if we look at workers, they can move under three of these regulations. And depending on under which framework you move, you have differential access to certain labor rights in the country where you work. So it's very important in terms of establishing your rights in a certain country under which freedom you move. But most of the workers have no idea of this whole regulatory context that surrounds their employment conditions, of course. They were just hired to do a job in another country, or they just moved themselves to a job in another country. So all these regulatory channels that are basically behind their employment relations are very unclear to them. So if we zoom into that, the first one is the simple one: free movement of labor. So if you're an EU citizen, you can just move to another EU country and take up local employment there. If you do that, you would just work with a Netherlands-based firm, for example, and you would simply be treated completely equal to any other Dutch worker in the Netherlands. So that one is very straightforward and very simple. Then you have the freedom of services. A worker can also be moving under the freedom of services within Europe. And that means that they are basically posted by a firm in one country to work in another country. The idea is that they provide a service in the other country. So the subcontractor in Poland gets a job or via tendering procedure, for example, to offer a service in the Netherlands. So construct part of a energy central in the Netherlands. So they take up the job and then they are allowed to take their own workers with them. So then the worker who would do the same kind of construction job as a worker who is individually moving to the Netherlands is then moving under a different framework. And this means different entitlements in terms of labor rights. The third option is the freedom of establishment, to make it even more complicated. So you're, as an EU citizen, you're allowed to start your own business in another country. So basically, if you would work as a self-employed person in the Netherlands, you move under a different freedom again within Europe, which is the freedom of establishment. And all these different freedoms are, even though these workers can do completely the same job, might even be sort of the whole migration context might still be arranged by the same sort of employer, their position in the Netherlands in terms of labor rights is completely different. If you work as a self-employed person, the statutory minimum wage, but also the collective agreements don't apply to you because you're a self-employed worker, you set your own tariffs. So it's very important to keep in mind that these different regulatory channels really define the different rights frameworks that these workers are entitled to. So as I said, I didn't encounter in my fieldwork any self-employed workers. I think this phenomenon is also a bit more prominent in the smaller scale construction than in large scale construction. So I won't go into that anymore. But if we look at the differentiation between rights, if you move under the freedom of people or if you move under the freedom of services, you see here the freedom of people, so that means that you are employed by a Dutch-based firm. Then you're completely, well, entitled to equal treatment with Dutch workers. The same rules apply, so basically host country rules apply. But if you move via the freedom of services, so posted employment, it becomes much more difficult because then you have the Posting of Workers Directive, an EU directive, which arranges which part of national legislation also apply to you as a foreign worker. So the Posting of Workers Directive applies to, for example, minimum wages, maximum working hours, minimum holidays. Those sorts of issues are arranged via the Posting of Workers Directive, but this is basically a minimum set of regulations that are arranged via this posting directive. And the countries have implemented the directive such that it's basically a maximum amount of conditions that they can guarantee for these workers. So the directive says, okay, we can, if you're a posted worker, you're entitled to this list of conditions, but national countries can't offer you more than that specific list as well. So it's quite difficult to establish. One thing to remember is that with posted employment, social security arrangements remain arranged in the sending country, so the country from where you were posted. And that means that all your social security contributions, but also your pension, for example, stays in the country from where you are posted. So if you are a posted worker from a Polish construction firm, that means that all your social security remains arranged in Poland, which sounds fair. If you're a hypermobile worker who moves around Europe all the time, then it's nice that all your social contributions are paid in your home country. But with posting, many firms start to shop between different EU countries in terms of where are the welfare states with lower social contributions, for example. So you have Cyprus, where social contributions are very low. And you see that many workers, even though they sometimes think they are posted from Poland, might in fact be posted via Cyprus, via a letterbox company in Cyprus, and then social security arrangements, if they are even made, are made in Cyprus, a country where the worker has never been to, nor would ever go to claim those benefits. So that's what you see within Europe, a whole issue of regime shopping or regime competition, as some people call it. Yeah. Is it clear? I see some confused faces, but...
For me, it's not clear.
No?
No. How does it work? Could it be possible? Yeah, if they are not resident in that country, how could it be possible that they are?
Yeah. Some legal scholars would say it shouldn't be possible because the firm doesn't really have a legal basis in that country. But checking whether a company is a genuine undertaking or not is very difficult, especially if you talk about cross-border, because enforcement agents are not cross-border mobile. I mean, sharing of information is very limited. So nobody really will look into if a firm is a letterbox company. For this worker to have the social security arranged in Cyprus, for example, the firm has to ask the Cypriotic social security authority to issue an A1 form, which states that the social security arrangements are made in the other country. And then this shows that this you show them to the Dutch authorities, and then you'll say, okay, the arrangements are made in the other country. And then nobody really looks into that.
The employer doesn't see
the employee sometimes, but oftentimes you see that contracts are set up in a language they don't understand. For example, a Cypriotic language. Sometimes you see that they have two contracts, one Polish contract, one in Dutch or English. It's really something. Yeah, they have lots of tricks to really circumvent these regulations or use these regulations in a way that is not what they were meant for. Yeah.
That's not technically legal.
No, but it's very difficult to really establish what firms can and cannot do in this matter. Of course, if it's really clear that it is a letterbox company, then it's not a genuine undertaking, and then you would say it's not legal. But first you have to establish that that's the case, and that's very difficult. Yeah. Sometimes you see that workers get posted from different countries. I talked, for example, to one Polish construction worker, and he had a Portuguese contract, because also social security benefits in Portugal are lower than in Poland. He went to Portugal for one day to show that he had a genuine employment relationship with that employer, and then was sent to work in the Netherlands just to save on social security costs. Yeah. For employers, it's quite lucrative if you save on these social security payments. I think you can make like 20 or 30% profit out of that. So, yeah.
But if employees feel cheated in any way, the workers, do they feel, is there a sense of, oh gosh, I've been cheated? Do they feel that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. If they know, then they would say, okay, this is not what should have happened, but knowing that and doing something about it. As I said, they compare it with other job opportunities at home or jobs abroad. I will show some quotes in a moment why they do act as they do. Yeah. So this is the first one. If you see all this regulatory mess within Europe, if you are an enforcement agent or an individual worker, finding out your employment conditions, well, it's very, very hard. So this one was explaining, okay, we see now that there are Polish agencies coming in that offer workers in the Netherlands for much lower rates. And of course, client firms will go for that because, I mean, if you save €2 an hour on a worker, I mean, those are massive savings in the end. And he was living in the Netherlands for a bit longer period, so he was not able to get into those Polish agencies anymore. And he said, okay, we really feel the competition coming in via these constructions, where these firms abuse the rules that are out there to employ these kind of labor migrants in the Netherlands. Here's another quote from a trade union official who says, okay, if you have just one worker, basically just talking with them doesn't solve the issue of where they were posted. Sometimes they talk to Polish workers and they say, yeah, I'm posted by a Polish firm. But when they look at the contracts, all of a sudden you get this third country option within their contract again. So then they found out that they were posted via Portugal or via Cyprus. So it's not just talking to the workers, you really have to check every individual contract and pay slips to see if social security payments are made as well within for those individual workers. So it's really a very, very complex phenomenon at the moment. Well, if you have figured out what kind of worker you are you a posted worker or are you a worker that moves under the freedom of people, or if you're even a self-employed worker, the help happens as well, that workers are basically self-employed even though they didn't even know that. If you know that, what your rights should be according to the law, then accessing them is really another matter. So another step. So this worker explains, okay, I know that there are collective agreement wages in the Netherlands, but basically finding out how that works is way too complicated. So if you're a construction worker, you have to look at the collective agreement for the construction sector in the Netherlands. But if you are, for example, a pipe fitter, we have five categories of pipe fitters. So then you have to look at what is your task on the construction site. So what kind of jobs do you regularly do on a daily basis, and that establishes your wage scale in the Netherlands on that construction site. So these are many, many steps you have to go through to really find out what should be your wage, your hourly wage in the Netherlands. I talked to a labor enforcer who says, okay, yeah, if we look on paper, everything is very nicely arranged, very dense and strict regulations in the Netherlands, but it has become so dense and so complicated because of this, well, what comes from Europe, these new regulations and how they are implemented, that it's not simply, okay, you're a German worker working in the Netherlands anymore. We have to find out much more information about each worker. So the enforcement of their labor rights has become much more complicated. So also if you talk with workers, for example, these were two workers that had worked for a couple of years in the Netherlands already, so this was not in construction, but meat workers. If you ask them, do you think you have the right to social assistance, for example, in the Netherlands when you lose your contract, they have no clue whatsoever. Many simply don't inform themselves about the labor rights in the Netherlands, and they're just happy as long as they have employment and earn a decent wage. So we've seen now that the labor rights of this group of workers is often get violated. But how about protection? Don't these workers get any protection? And I basically, in my research, I looked at trade union protection. So that's what I will go into now. I'm not even halfway through the presentation yet, so I'll speed it up a bit.
I think there is nothing after.
Yeah, okay, so then please come with questions as we go, and then
I do have a question then, because you talk about social protection, taking the case of a Polish worker who didn't know that actually he was a contract from Poland, but it could be from Romania. Mm-hmm. So I was just wondering in terms of if he's sick, does it make any difference for him? He has to go to hospital, and then probably, like you're saying, there is a form. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But then, does he have to do something because it's Poland, because it's from Romania? Does it make a change in terms of social security and the rights that he actually has access to in the Netherlands?
Yeah, no, absolutely, it makes a difference. Of course, for emergency medical aid, it doesn't, because that's something you're entitled to anyways, regardless of your contract. But if you have to recover from a serious injury, for example, mm-hmm. then you have to claim sickness benefits from your social insurance provider. And if you are posted via Romania or any other country, you have to claim your sickness benefits in that country. And that's where the trouble comes in.
Like if you are sick, like you are recovering, then you will stay in the Netherlands, but then it's Romania who is going to be sending the money back to you to the Netherlands.
Yeah. Yeah, or if you recover in Poland, if you're a Polish national, I guess that usually you go back home and recover there. And then Romania has to pay your sickness benefits. But of course, those can be much lower, for example, than what you were used to, than when you would get sickness benefits in Poland. So all these regulations are much, much different. And you'll see when everything goes well, there are no problems, then also for the workers, it doesn't really matter that much, maybe. But once these sort of issues happen, then you can really see in the longer term how it affects them. Yeah. But not that much is known about whether and how many of these workers get into these kinds of troubles. But the cases we have seen were, of course, quite extreme, because then they got a work injury and really ended up in limbo because they were facing several different social security regimes.
Because no one is actually helping them.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, and it's a new phenomenon, so also not that much is known about it then. It's really difficult to navigate this administrative cross-border mess. Yeah, and especially if you're ill. And then you have to deal with those kinds of things. Yeah. Yeah.
A question a bit similar to what she said is that I think you mentioned that most of them is coming from Poland. Right.
In the Netherlands, yeah.
In the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering whether it was there was an historical reason behind that, or because we can expect that maybe people coming from North Africa as well are in this situation, mm-hmm. and because Poland now is in the EU compared to North Africa, what is make the difference between these two groups, mm-hmm. even if they are working in the construction right now?
Yeah. Yeah.
Could you elaborate a bit on that?
Yeah, well, the main difference between them would be that the North Africans, or at least the Moroccans and the Turkish migrants that we saw in the Netherlands, were employed by Dutch-based firms. So in that sense, completely entitled to equal treatment to Dutch workers, whereas now with Poland and the EU regulations, you have a differentiation on, in terms of rights depending on under which freedom of movement they come here to work.
So
yeah.
You mean that the citizenship did not matter, it's much more who is the citizenship of your employer, mm-hmm. it's much more...
Yeah, and under which regulatory frame does regulate your employment relation, yeah.
Related to this question, why would they take a Polish migrant through a Portuguese company or whatever? Mm-hmm. Instead of hiring directly a Portuguese.
Yeah. Well, some of these firms are Polish-based firms and just have subsidiaries everywhere. And then in terms of language, they're more comfortable with Polish workers simply because in construction, they often have these work teams that are aligned on the basis of nationality. So then you prefer to group a group of Polish workers together because they can communicate in their own language. Whereas if you have to...
In the Netherlands already. The contacts in the Netherlands are more... comfortable in Polish.
No, just the firm that is operating. They send out employees, so basically work teams that they arrange, and then they prefer to have one set of nationalities employed via that firm. Of course, if you're a Polish firm and you have to hire Portuguese workers, then you also have to have people that speak Polish and Portuguese or can at least work in both languages, and that's not that common. Yeah.
Have something a bit.
Go ahead.
My question is, when we saw this your presentation, we understand that there's no negotiation at all, mm-hmm. but on the employees side compared to the employer. It seems that the employers, if they want to choose a Polish guy that picked these people, and if these people don't want to be hired for this job, they can choose
just take someone else. Yeah.
Is that what they
If you look at the balance of power, it's really clearly in favor of the employers at the moment. Okay. Yeah. And that's also where trade unions come in. It's very difficult to bargain with these employers. Yeah.
Okay, so my second point is that because you said that a Polish guy costs approximately €2 per hour or something like that.
€2 less,
What services or facilities the employers provide through this contract? So I suspect that maybe you have, like in Gulf countries, some labor camp somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And do they provide any, I don't know, I'm not sure, but social services about that, or any other
Social services,
like bus company.
Yeah, basically they arrange everything for the workers. So accommodation, bus transport from work to the accommodation, but also bus transport between the Netherlands and Poland.
Nothing about social services. So I don't know, voucher. If you are sick, for example, you can go in certain hospital, but not
that much.
Hospital.
No, in terms of like if they get ill, then they're oftentimes left to themselves. Yeah, or just fired and sent away. Okay, I can't use you anymore.
So it means as well that they are coming mostly alone, without family, without children.
Yeah, most of the ones that I interviewed, especially if they are very cross-border mobile, then they are without families. So in construction, nobody has families. But if they are agency workers, sometimes they reside for a bit longer period in the Netherlands. Then sometimes they have families here, but not that often, because simply the contracts that they work under are so precarious. So it's basically, they're often treated as day laborers. So today you have work, tomorrow, who knows? So you can't really do anything. And why the employers are able to arrange so much for these workers is because simply they don't have any guaranteed income. So even if they want to hire or find their own accommodation, I mean, they don't have any financial grounds or basis to really rent an individual place. So that's really what creates the dependency there. Yeah. Yeah. So let's go to trade unions and what they can or can't do to protect these workers. Well, I have some general stuff about trade unions, but I won't really go into that. The difficulty with trade unions is that they traditionally are very nationally focused, so focused on Dutch workers in the Netherlands, in the UK on UK workers, and also on workers that are on permanent stable contracts. So this whole new labor force of migrant workers, but also of other types of flex workers, are very poorly represented oftentimes in trade union structures. And you see that all over Europe. There are of course changes. Trade unions try to also accommodate for these migrant workers, but they encounter lots of hurdles in representing them. Because of the time, I won't go into this. There are lots of interesting organizing campaigns. We can talk about it if you like, but I'll just move to the enforcement of EU migrant labor rights. If you look at EU unions, most of them campaign for equal work, for equal pay. So basically every worker that works in their countries should be treated equally as a national worker. But the difficulty at the moment with EU migrants is these changed employment structures. So it has become so difficult to really establish under what conditions these workers are employed in a certain country. Plus, especially in construction, you see that you have these long contracting chains. So you have a main contractor who subcontracts, who subcontracts, who subcontracts, who subcontracts, and then you get this whole change and everybody scooch down the risks of employment. So addressing the real employer of a worker, or even finding out who is their real employer, is very, very difficult. So this is a picture of one of my field work where the trade unionists are putting up a banner, equal work for equal pay. And then they had done some research amongst one of the consortiums supplying pipe fitters on the construction site, and they saw that there was clearly a differentiation in terms of wages according to nationality. So Jan would be the Dutch worker earning 13 euros, and then you would have José, the Portuguese worker, and then the Polish Janek in the bottom. So even though they did completely the same work, working for the same consortium of firms, they earned different wages. So you see that workers really use differences across borders and the different difficulties in enforcing labor rights across borders to their monetary advantage. So what the trade unions did on these construction sites is basically, on these construction sites, 2,000 to 3,000 workers were employed, and the union had no idea about their conditions. Nobody was complaining, so you can say, okay, nobody complains, then things will be in order. But once you start looking into the exact conditions, you find out these kinds of differences. So what they did was really informing the workers of their rights and telling them that they could come to trade unions as well if they wanted to do something about it. But they really see that it's very difficult to motivate them to do so. They're quite happy with what they earn oftentimes, except when they run into problems. So they don't become members. They're often very short-term in the countries where they work. Language issues, employee intimidation, retaliation. If they even suspect you're with the trade union or talking with unions, you can just go back to Poland, for example. And then lack of knowledge of the institutional structures in the countries where they work is really a big barrier to organize these workers. So here are some quotes from the field work, where a trade unionist basically says, okay, we can try, But the ones who get victimized are the workers with the slightest suspicion. So even if they didn't make any changes for the workers, they are fired directly already. A worker that says, okay, I learned that though it's said that trade unions help workers, the reality is that you just have to look after yourself. And that's what many of these workers do. They prefer to look after themselves instead of going to a trade union or fight unfair treatment of their employers. And then you see the labor market, the job market is very competitive. Like we said, basically 10 other workers are lined up for your job. So if you start complaining, you can basically move on to another job or back home and be unemployed. So that's why they oftentimes, sort of accept these substandard conditions. Like this Portuguese worker says very well, if I don't accept it, someone else will come. There have been jobs where I said no, and a lot of Portuguese guys said no, but then other guys came and said, okay. Well, yeah, a bad paying job is sometimes better than no job at all. So what's the alternative?
You see any tension between the native workers and the foreign workers who work in the same company?
Yeah.
Less.
Yeah, yeah. You do see that sometimes. In construction, it was difficult because these were really a national based firms. So you didn't see that many firms that both had Dutch and foreign workers employed. But you see the competition between the firms and the different nationalities.
You see the fear, maybe, the fear that native people seems to be, replaced by foreign workers that arrive from Poland.
Yeah, you see that a lot. Yeah, especially in construction, especially when things went south during the crisis, and then new jobs open up, and then they're basically filled with cheap labor from Poland. Yeah. Yeah, you do see that a lot. The difficulty is on those construction sites I researched, there were not that many Dutch laborers present. And the ones that I talked to were not very interested in being interviewed and said, well, basically, we don't really have much contact with them. And if we do, then, yeah, of course, we see that they work on their very substandard rates. Yeah, and that creates problems. Yeah.
What about the trade unions from Poland?
Mm-hmm.
They try to do something for the Polish migrants.
Yeah. I don't know of many initiatives. There are some bilateral cooperations between trade unions, but there's not a very intensive collaboration. Also, in terms of informing migrants of their labor rights, it's starting to develop, but it's not that extensive yet. No. In terms of being informed about labor conditions abroad, it's really something the workers themselves have to search for, and then information is available, but usually basic information. So what is the minimum wage in the Netherlands? But if you're a construction worker, you can find out that the minimum wage is around 850 euros, but if you are a construction worker, you are entitled to much more than that.
Want to wrap up with conclusion?
Yeah, I had this whole part about labor practices, but it's all exactly. It's all in my PhD, and it's all published. It's an article-based PhD, so it's all published in different articles. So you can just access it online. Just send me an email. Everything that I was talking about was just to get to what do workers then do given these constraints under the EU labor market. So just read about that in a later stage if you're interested. But I think the conclusion, unfortunately, is really that you see that these workers are oftentimes very excluded from their labor rights, even though the regulations are there. There are so many constraints at the moment, especially because of the cross-border context. I think that's really important to keep in mind. That really prohibits them accessing their labor rights when they work abroad. So now we've only looked into the Netherlands, where the regulations are quite good, stringent, but in other countries this is quite a different situation. But still, you see, in terms of conditions that these migrants face, you see problems popping up in all these Western countries, or at least these countries where EU migrants are employed oftentimes. You see the trade unions, who are the main enforcers, at least in the Netherlands. Enforcement is also very differently arranged in different countries. In the Netherlands, the enforcement of the collective agreements is the job of trade unions, and they have really very much difficulties in enforcing the labor rights of these workers. Plus, given all these limitations and the limited effectiveness of trade unions when they start enforcing, like the quote I showed from this trade unionist, even though if we do something, they are the ones that get hurt oftentimes. So basically, they don't really benefit once we start enforcing. So that's when you see that, like, the standard procedures that were in place for regular or Dutch workers, or maybe even the former guest workers, are not really the institutions that these workers would go to if they are in troubles. So you see that they face very limited protection, but also themselves have limited opportunities to really try to change their position in the Netherlands. So given that fact, if you want to make changes for these workers, it's not only about the regulations that are in place, but it's also about enforcement and really trying to actively create changes for these workers. So that's really for different organizations a job to do in the future, probably.